Welcome to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson. For today's Walnut Wednesday show, I talked with Dr. Christy Sanchez, senior researcher and nematologist with TriCal, about managing nematodes in orchards.
This segment was sponsored by the California Walnut Board.
My name is Christy Sanchez. I am a senior researcher and nematologist for TriCal Diagnostics and TriCal.
Let's start out with talking about the research program that TriCal has and what you provide for growers.
Yes. So the nice thing with TriCal and TriCal Diagnostics, I would say we do provide the full package for growers. Our primary goal is to provide growers support in their management decisions, as well as really help growers diagnose nematode issues. And we are performing nematology research. We've established multi-year research field trials, evaluating the performance of the fumigant treatments such as Telon and chloropicrin, and also evaluating chloropicrin adoption into orchards, especially in situations where townships have capped out on Telon use. We've initiated trial work through the Valley in Northern California, testing on various key crops such as walnuts, almonds, citrus, and grape to really determine the efficacy of the fumigant applications. We're investigating depths, rates, combinations of the fumigants, as well as looking at post-treatment nematicides for growers. We do conduct a very thorough investigation on plant parasitic nematode evals. We do a pre and a post fumigation, as well as a post planting through the seasons to fully examine the nematicidal efficacy of the fumigants, as well as monitoring tree growth.
So what are some of the key plant parasitic nematode pests that orchard growers should be concerned with?
Yes. So when it comes to orchard growers, such as like walnuts and almonds, there are three key plant parasitic nematodes that do impact perennial crops. This consists of root lesion nematode, ring nematode, and root knot nematode. Plant parasitic nematodes such as these key pests do affect roughly 35% of almond and stone fruit acreage in California. When you're looking at root lesion nematode, it's widespread in walnut producing areas, where it's estimated to be present in approximately 85% of walnut orchards. The feeding activities of these plant parasitic nematodes, it does result in plant root destruction, decreasing water and nutrient uptake by the plant. And this is where we visually can see root and foliar symptoms. It's also important to know when it comes to these plant parasitic nematodes, they can survive as eggs in the soil, as well as adults and juveniles, if a food source such as roots are present. It is vital to remember for orchard growers that tree roots can live and host nematodes for several years after a mature tree has been removed. Therefore, root removal to the maximal possible depth will help reduce nematode populations.
As orchard growers and other growers are looking to see what kind of problems they have, what is the importance of soil and root soil sampling to making their management decisions?
So when it comes for growers to making key management decisions, it's critical to know what plant parasitic nematodes are present and their relative population densities. When you're looking at symptoms, they can vary greatly and may be quite indistinct in the fields. Above ground, you can see water, nutrient stress, you'll see premature wilting, stunting, chlorosis. But symptoms from nematodes are not uniform in a field. So you'll see patchy kind of hotspots within the field itself. Nematode problems are often misdiagnosed and blamed on lack of fertilizer and water. And that's why it's very critical to collect soil and root samples from the field to determine if you have a nematode problem. To make a thorough diagnosis, I always say it's best to base it on four key factors, looking at foliar and root symptoms, but also looking at the field history. That can provide some valuable clues to identify what nematodes and other pest problems were in the field, especially if a grower from a previous crop had the field sampled, took it in for analysis. Once he sees what plant parasitic nematodes are present, more than likely those nematodes are present now. So when determining what nematodes you have in a field, it's very critical to collect plant roots and soil to really confirm the presence of nematodes. And this is where growers can send them off to a laboratory diagnostic lab.
So let's talk about the importance of soil fumigation for growers and also some of the benefits for replant orchards.
So first, soil fumigation, it's an important from an agronomic standpoint by providing control or suppression of broad spectrum of soil-borne pests such as weeds, plant parasitic nematodes, and various soil pathogens such as root rot, Phytophthora, and Prunus replant disorder. For pretreatment control, soil fumigation is the standard management tool for growers to help reduce nematode populations to a level where serious crop damage will not result. At Tri-Cal, they have been providing support to growers over 50 years in regards to fumigation. In our research, we have found that orchards that do start in fumigated soil do experience rapid seedling establishment, increases in early growth, earlier and larger harvest yields, as well as increases in orchard longevity. So for soil fumigation, it definitely helps promote healthy soil for growers' long-term investment. It leads to a flourishing root system, which enhances trunk, shoot, and canopy growth. And in some of the research field trials I have going on now that I've been conducting for the past 3 years, we are definitely seeing that evidence visually in the field.
All right, Christy, is there anything that we missed or anything else that you think that our listeners should know?
I would say pretty much here at Tri-Cal and Tri-Cal Diagnostics, our primary goal is just providing support to growers and making sure we offer assistance for their IPM decisions. We really want to help in regards to pre-plant measures, fumigation, but also looking at post-plant treatments after you fumigate, looking at nematicides, which can help promote long-term crop protection through the seasons. Another big thing is talking about Tri-Cal R&D, how we are really looking and conducting key critical field trial research where we're investigating nematicidal efficacy of chloropicrin and tillum through the seasons to really showcase the benefits of nematode control.
Taylor has more for Walnut Wednesday in segment 3. Our news brief is up next. We will be right back.
The California Walnut Board and Commission provides value to the California walnut industry by working together with growers and handlers to advance the industry. Together, the California Walnut Board and Commission are helping to protect, develop, and grow California walnuts domestically and internationally. The California Walnut Board provides funding and strategic direction on walnut production and post-harvest research designed to help support the industry and promote California walnuts. To learn more, visit our website at walnuts.org. Together we grow.
Don't let your soils become tainted and unproductive from excess salts. Take care of your crops while caring for your soil. Cation X5 Plus by AgroPlante is a soil conditioner meant to maximize water penetration by combating harmful salts in the soil, which can injure your crops and bottom line. Cation X5 Plus also corrects sulfur and calcium plant deficiencies. AgroPlante wants to help you grow your crop. Contact us today to find out more at 559-498-0388 or visit us at www.agroplante.com.
AgroMiora Nursery is the premier nursery in California. Whether it's almonds, walnuts, pistachios, prunes, or olives, AgroMiora has been the grower's source for over 20 years and is the home of RootPack R Almond, Grizzly Walnut, and the North American plants UCB1 and Platinum Clonal Pistachio Rootstocks. As the worldwide leader in super high-density almonds, olives, and prunes, AgroMiora can show you how to cut costs and increase yields with their super high-density rootstock RootPack 20. For more information or to schedule a site visit, contact a representative at 530-812-3398 today.
Welcome back. Here's your news brief for today. USDA is highlighting how food loss and waste is directly related to climate change. Stephanie Ho has the story.
USDA recently hosted a virtual roundtable to shine a spotlight on the issue of food loss and waste, which is actually a bigger deal than many people may think.
In the U.S., it's estimated 30 to 40% of the food produced is lost or wasted along the supply chain. At the retail and consumer levels alone, this tallies up to around $161 billion each year. Put differently, a household of four spends on average $1,500 each year on food that ends up uneaten.
That was Deputy Agriculture Secretary Jule Brunaugh. She was joined in addressing the session by Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Michael Regan, who pointed out that food waste and climate change are directly connected.
Food is the most common material found in our landfills. EPA estimates that food waste represents more than 20% of the trash that Americans generate. When food ends up in landfills, it releases methane, a powerful greenhouse gas. Nearly 8% of global greenhouse gas emissions come from food loss and waste.
One speaker at the USDA-hosted event was Sarah Fateh from the San Diego Food System Alliance. Her organization recently completed a 15-month online program called Save the Food San Diego Eco Challenge, which used social media methods to engage residents to reduce food waste.
We provided each participant with a high-quality scale that they would use to actually weigh out their food waste. And then we fully customized the Eco Challenge website so that participants could actually log on and record their food waste directly on the website.
The Alliance's goal was for participants to reduce their food waste by 10%.
Among those program participants that completed the 5 food waste tracking periods, we found a 38% reduction in household level food waste, which was incredible and really far exceeded that 10% goal that we had initially set.
I think you have to start with households because the evidence suggests from a waste perspective, at least that's where the majority of waste comes from.
That was Speaker Wayne Hubbard with ReLondon, the London Waste and Recycling Board. In Britain, concrete tips also are important.
Things like shopping lists, freezing cheese, you know, all these kind of activities, you give householders hints and tips, you know, saving money. We saw a dramatic reduction in food waste since 2008 when the crash happened, as people were, you know, trying to be more efficient and save money. Then that never really got back to the pre-2008 levels in terms of waste. So those habits stuck.
His office is working on a report to analyze the flow of food.
And already it's given us some really interesting insights into how much food is lost before it even gets to London, and then how much food is further lost within the supply chain at the end.
To further underscore the link between food waste and climate change, the results of the report will be released at the upcoming United Nations Climate Change Conference in Glasgow in November. This is Stephanie Ho for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
The UN Food System Summit will hear firsthand from an American farmer about U.S. advances in climate-smart agriculture. Michael Clements shares more on how American agriculture fits in the global climate discussion.
The UN Food System Summit this week will include farmers and ranchers representing U.S. agriculture. American Farm Bureau Federation President Zippy Duvall explains the importance of having U.S. farmers at the table.
UN policies haven't always recognized U.S. agriculture as a leader in this area. And for the first time, farmers and ranchers have been asked to be part of this discussion. They're going to be at a table. And we should be engaged to help influence the UN in their opinion on American agriculture. I'm pleased at the work USFRA has done to get farmers at the conference, and I also am pleased that we're going to have a U.S. farmer speaking there and several others farmers attending.
Duvall says U.S. farmers and ranchers have a fantastic sustainability story to share.
American farmers are setting the table for a healthy plate and a healthy planet, contributing just 10% of overall greenhouse gas emissions. That's far less than other sectors in our country, and it's also far less than agriculture in many other countries. Our farmers have voluntarily enrolled over 140 million acres in conservation programs. That equals the landmass of California and New York State combined. We also, in 2018, the use of ethanol and biofuels led to the reduction of greenhouse gas emissions equal to taking 17 million cars off the road.
The UN Food System Summit takes place during Climate Week 2021, but Duvall adds farmers and ranchers can share their story year-round.
Our research has shown that farming is among the most trusted professions when it comes to climate and environment. It's good to be proud of the work that we are doing on our farms to leave it in better environmental shape than what we found it. Talking about what we have done and why we have done it is important. Social media is a great tool, but it never replaces an in-person on-farm visit. And it always helps when we ask local news stations or school children or just local people to come in and visit our farms.
Learn more at fb.org/sustainability. Michael Clements, Washington.
The World Organization for Animal Health this week confirmed finding African swine fever in Haiti. Haiti borders the Dominican Republic, which confirmed the virus was in country this summer. The U.S. Department of Agriculture found the disease last week through testing at the Foreign Animal Disease Diagnostic Laboratory on Plum Island, New York. The stakes are very high in the battle to keep African swine fever out of the U.S. Gary Crawford has more.
African swine fever is a virus of pigs originating in Africa and has spread rapidly through Asia and into Europe. 2 years ago, it decimated the pig population in China. And it's not in the U.S. now, but getting close, just recently showing up in the Dominican Republic. As the U.S. government and swine industry work to keep it out of the U.S., the question continues to be asked.
What's at stake here in the pork industry related to African swine fever?
And there's certainly a lot at stake, according to Dr. Patrick Webb. He's director of swine health for the National Pork Board. He told a special USDA African swine fever webinar that the U.S. pork industry is more dependent on exporting pork than ever before. He said 20 years ago, the U.S. harvested 98 million head, exported about 8% of our pork production, and returns to producers from exports about $16. Now, fast forward to this year.
In 2021, you can see we have 131 million harvested. We're exporting 26.6% and that $58.65 per head value. So the industry's on the move.
Because the import gates of most nations are currently open to U.S. pork products. But even if one pig in this country were to get the disease, those gates would rapidly close. Wouldn't matter if the pig were a feral pig, backyard pig, or part of a commercial herd.
It really doesn't matter who has the pig. That one case is going to affect our trade. And that is some significant losses.
And as far as that $58 a head return to producers from exports,
we are going to basically shave that right off the top.
And that's not counting the loss of production and the costs of swine house cleanup and other costs. Patrick Webb showed us a study done by Iowa State University.
That study basically told us as an industry that if we can control an outbreak and our exports would come back within 2 years after that first case, we would see $15 billion in lost revenue, but we wouldn't see much contraction of the industry.
However, most experts say it would take much longer to eradicate the disease and get those import gates open again. The study said if it took 10 years to do that.
We're talking $50 billion in lost revenue and 140,000 lost jobs and significant contraction of the industry.
Which would have, of course, major repercussions.
Not only to pork producers, but as well to the economy.
This is Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Christmas tree growers are overcoming logistical challenges of COVID-19 and a heat wave in the Pacific Northwest to provide enough trees for the 2021 demand. After close evaluation and making tree-by-tree decisions, growers expect to supply the same overall number of real Christmas trees to the marketplace this season as they had planned before the crisis hit. With just about 8 weeks to go until the real Christmas tree shopping season hits, industry experts are confident there will be a real Christmas tree for everyone who wants one this year. That's our news for today. We will be right back.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcast, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
Hi, welcome to My Ag Life. Today we're talking with Davin Noreen, walnut grower and manager with Noreen Ranches, about the new UC Davis walnut variety Wolfskill's effectiveness as an early season variety. Welcome, Davin.
Good afternoon, Taylor.
Great to have you today. Davin, my first question for you here, can you tell me a little bit about your operation? You know, how many acres do you grow and where is the orchard located?
Yeah, so it's a family operation that I primarily work on. We have about 800 acres of walnuts, about 600 that are mature in full production. We're located in Rio Oso. I manage and consult on some other properties, and it's all located very central in Rio Oso. Rio Oso is in the southern end of the Sacramento Valley, 35 miles north of Sacramento. We're located on the east side of the Feather River, near the confluence of the Bear River and the Feather River. So I would characterize our location as a relatively cool climate for the walnut, the Central Valley walnut growing region. We're fairly close to the Delta. We get fairly warm temperatures, high 90s, 100 through the peak summer months. But we typically always cool off to low 60s or sub 60 at night because we do get quite a bit of Delta breeze influence.
Davin, let's talk about Wolfskill here for a sec. What initially drew you to planting Wolfskill in your guys' walnut orchards? You know, what attributes of that variety stood out to you guys?
Yeah, so since we've been involved with the plant breeding program, the Walnut Improvement Program at Davis, we've been, you know, looking for a replacement early season variety, one that would have a higher value than our current early season varieties, and also one that wasn't so susceptible so readily infected by walnut blight.
Can you tell me a little bit for a second about your partnership with the Walnut Improvement Program? Did they provide those trees for you guys? Was there an incentive for you?
Yes, the tissue came from the Walnut Improvement Program at Davis. There's no incentive other than just collaborating and working with the university and trying to help the industry. I mean, the greatest incentive is just learning, you know, seeing what's coming next to the industry.
Davin, you talked about earliness a little bit already, but, you know, Wolfskill, you know, earliness is its greatest attribute. How is an earlier harvest beneficial for a grower's expenditures?
Yeah, it's definitely one of its key attributes. Being early allows us to extend our harvest over a longer period of time. Currently, with the heritage varieties, if you will, that we have, we'd start harvest in early to middle September, and it would extend all the way to the 1st of November. As we start replacing those heritage varieties, we've been left with only two or three primary varieties in the middle of the season, and that doesn't let you capture the full capital investment or utilize it the best if you're trying to smash everything into a 4 week period versus an 8 week period.
The earlier harvesting aspect of it has maybe an effect on yields. I'm curious, since Chandler still makes up a lot of the acreage in the state of California, how do Wolfskill's yields compare to Chandler or maybe some of the other popular varieties?
Yeah, I'd say they're Wolfskill's yields are similar to Howard from what we've seen so far. That being that they show a tendency, at least in our location, to have greater yields earlier than Chandler does. Chandler does very well, but takes a year or two longer to get fully mature, established yields as compared to Howard. Wolfskill seems to be more on the front end, where you're going to start seeing higher tonnage, really in those in that fifth and sixth leaf.
Davin, how does Wolfskill stack up against some of the other early season varieties specifically that have come out of the Walnut Improvement Program, you know, in terms of things like blight and chill resistance?
Yeah, one of the reasons we like it is it seems to be less susceptible or have more tolerance to blight. I do see incidences of blight in our trees, which are 7 years old now, but it seems to be very treatable with our commercial standard sprays. It's been better than some of the other early varieties that have come out of the Walnut Improvement Program. It also shows very good color, very good beet yields. Colors can be similar to Chandler. Meat yields up there in the 50%+ range.
Talking about the blight resistance, how Wolfskill does have a higher resistance, you know, during the season, how does that really affect a grower's bottom line in terms of cost, you know, maybe compared to some of these other trees that don't have that high of a resistance?
Yeah, it definitely seems more tolerant. We get in trouble when we say resistant. But varieties that that you don't have to spray as many times are going to be more give you a better profit margin or more wiggle room on the profitability side. A lot of our early varieties here in the Sacramento Valley, we're accustomed to spraying 6 or 7 times for blight starting in the middle of March. And going into June sometimes. So spraying that often when you're achieving pretty low prices is kind of a double whammy. Wolfskill shows potential to be tolerant and also has kernel qualities to achieve more Chandler, Howard, Tulare-like pricing.
Okay. Davin, I want to get in a little bit about your guys' rootstock choice for your Wolfskill acreage. You know, what rootstocks are you guys growing your trees on right now, and how have those performed thus far?
The seventh leaf Wolfskill that we have are planted on 4 different rootstocks. There's 5 trees on 4 different rootstocks, so 20 trees total. We used a Paradox seedling rootstock as one of the treatments, that was an in-house seedling that we produce on our ranch, and then we used the other 3 major clonal varieties that are available to the industry right now. So it's planted on Vlach, RX1, and VX211. It's performed well on and equally well without doing any measurements, just anecdotally looking at the canopy size, trunk size, yields. There doesn't seem to be any significant difference among any of the clonal rootstocks. Hasn't done as well on the Paradox seedlings. They're notably smaller and less vigorous than the clones.
Is there any maybe particular reasoning behind why the clonals are doing better than the seedlings?
Well, we anticipate that the clones that are available to the industry are superior to most Paradox seedlings that you find. We've done very well with this particular seed source over the course of planting it on our ranch. We have several hundred acres planted from this seed source. However, you know, that was the expectation with these clones, is that they should be superior to typical seedlings. But seedlings are also just one-offs, and it's only 5 trees, so there's really no statistical significance.
That is a good point. The number of trees would not be high enough to really test that theory. Maybe some other growers throughout the state have tested that a little further with the seedlings. But speaking to the bigger picture of Wolfskill in the state. I have one more question for you on that. Davin, do you have any other thoughts on the future of Wolfskill for the California walnut industry?
You know, new varieties are always a gamble. There is no sure thing. You do not know anything until you've had them in a commercial setting for 15, 20 years. That's really how long it takes to learn if you've got a winner or something that's really subpar. So it's a gamble. It's a risk. I would say that Wolfskill appears to be a risk worth taking at this point.
Okay. Yeah, that's a good sentiment there. You know, even I like the point you make where, you know, you do have to wait, but the attributes that it has, you know, presented itself with up to this point do seem promising, and they do have their benefits. So hopefully Wolfskill ends up getting people to increase the acreage and is just a better option as an early season variety for the walnut industry in the future.
Absolutely. That's all we can hope for is another tool for growers in our industry.
Definitely. Well, thank you, Davin, for coming on today and talking about Wolfskill. We hope to hear more about this variety from UC and anywhere else in the future. Hopefully good things. I appreciate you coming on today.
My pleasure, Taylor. I appreciate you having me.
This is Taylor with My Ag Life.
Soil fumigation is a critical step to ensure that your orchard gets off to a good start. Trichlor is a pre-plant soil fumigant and is the foundation for a successful pest management system. Targeted pathogens include soil-borne disease and nematodes. Fumigation helps to create a healthy soil environment that allows the plant's root system to flourish. For more information about Trichlor or to schedule an application, contact Trical Incorporated at 669-327-5076 or visit www.trical.com.
Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236 or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you.
Welcome back. Senator John Bozeman of Arkansas spoke recently at a webinar titled Sustainable Solutions for Zero Hunger by 2030, A Vision for Animal Agriculture. The webinar was hosted by AgriPulse. Here are his comments.
Well, thank you so much for having me and again, for all of the hard work in putting this really important symposium together. So good afternoon. And again, thank you for inviting me to join today's event. The theme of this event, Sustainable Solutions for Zero Hunger, recognizes what I consider to be a critical component of the discussions on agriculture and climate change, that agricultural sustainability must be promoted while simultaneously ensuring food security. There are a variety of emerging and novel roles for agriculture to play in addressing climate change, which are generating a lot of buzz in Washington and interest from the agricultural community. While these new opportunities hold promise, our efforts to foster positive change in our food system to mitigate the impacts of climate change must also ensure, and this is very important, that we maintain yields and profitability for farmers and affordability for consumers. I recently visited farms in Arkansas where producers are serving as pioneers, navigating these new opportunities to determine the long-term viability of incorporating climate-oriented practices into their operations. While these producers are ever optimistic and hopeful that their efforts will pay off, profitability is a necessary and vital consideration. Any approach that requires farmers and ranchers to take additional costs and risk with zero reward simply will not succeed. We cannot expect farmers to offset lost production with unpredictable income streams from emerging and evolving greenhouse gas markets. And I question the ability of the government to pay for lost production due to aggressive conservation efforts. Discovery of new technologies and support of public policy that continues to promote them is going to be the key to meeting the climate and hunger challenges of the future. Unfortunately for agriculture, animal agriculture in particular, science and technology is often viewed skeptically. Washington is comfortable talking about increasing our conservation efforts and getting more farmers involved in offset markets, but ensuring our policies, both domestically and internationally, stay rooted in science, safety, and proper consideration for risk and benefits will be critical in securing a future that prioritizes both sustainability and food security. International bodies such as CODEX and the UN Food Systems Summit are coming under increasing pressure from countries urging the precautionary principle in an idyllic view of agriculture. Within our own government, we are seeing resistance to modernizing regulatory approvals for important tools like animal biotechnology. Forcing radical reforms on U.S. agriculture under the guise of responding to climate change is concerning to me. Animal husbandry practices have evolved to maximize growth of the animal and to reduce the use of the resources required to produce that animal protein, including water, feed, and land. Reverting our animal production practices to the pastoral scenes of my parents' time, an approach advocated by the European Commission, not only harms the environment, but it also contributes to hunger and increased food costs. Just this week, the House Democrats selected their winners and losers when it comes to climate policy as the agricultural portion of the partisan reconciliation bill advanced through the House. Importantly, it advanced through the House with $28 billion. Or to put that in perspective, 30% of the total spending for the agriculture and conservation components has yet to be made public. This legislation was debated without stakeholder input. More than $66 billion was directed towards research and infrastructure initiatives focusing on urban agriculture, civilian climate core, organic, specialty crops, tree equity, whatever that is, and so on. And what we've seen so far, not a single dollar in that $94 billion package was devoted to animal agriculture. The segment of American agriculture responsible for over half of our country's farm receipts was left out in the cold entirely. This signals to me that the administration is not interested in assisting animal agriculture in being more sustainable. The White House has its own agenda. The president and his allies have little regard for the impact of their decisions on the agriculture community as a whole. The fact that they have refused to consider your voices in the discussion but should be very alarming as a decision on where to spend this money, or in this case, where not to, will have long-term ramifications on the industry's future. If the U.S. intends to continue the evolution of our food system in order to combat climate change head on, then we must be sure our policies don't obstruct or distort the increasingly difficult task of food production for global population. If we want to successfully encourage climate change mitigation, farmers and ranchers must have all the tools they will need to utilize in this endeavor. In this forum today, where you're exploring the concepts of both sustainability and hunger, rather than speaking about each in isolation, the holistic and wise approach that I feel is necessary to ensure we are achieving meaningful process, we have to speak to them together. I thank you for your time and your prioritization of these important issues. And it's really a pleasure to be with you. And thank you for all that you're doing. Again, this is a matter of us all working together, and we can so be so very blessed. The Lord has blessed us so much with the resources that we have. And people ask me about, you know, what am I enthusiastic about? I'm enthusiastic after spending, 10 days, 2 weeks with our farm families in Arkansas on our ag tour. Folks that have so much ingenuity and just, are going to get the job done. They always have. So we just need them to give them the resources and the ability to do that. And we will continue being the great food production nation that we are. Thank you.
And that's our show for today. If there's a topic you'd like to hear more about, send me an email to sabrina@myaglife.com. This is the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson. From the JCS Marketing Team, thanks for listening.